Coming up on Life is a Festival.
To see what I really am, this like spiritual being, but not just lean on that as a way to dissociate from the human experience, but rather to let it be a place to stand where I can see both the spiritual body and the physical body in this material realm, understand the ways in which I've been carrying certain pains and traumas and subconscious patterning, and reintegrating that in some beautiful and surprisingly deep and effective ways so that I can live more wholly and just truly feel that it's so silly, not in a pejorative way, but like just laugh at it, laugh with it, you know, all these different parts of me just coming together and be like, oh, this silly life thing, no, you're doing so great.
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. Today's episode is dedicated to Evyatar Frankl, my dear friend, who died a week ago due to complications from a rare lymphoma. I sat in a men's circle with Ev for the better part of his journey with cancer, and in each of our weekly sessions and in many, many private conversations outside of those sessions, he showed up with such extraordinary grace. And this is what we all felt about him, this idea of grace. He had so much grace. And I wanted to record a podcast with him to understand his philosophy, to understand how he was able to meet something, this potentially terminal, and indeed ultimately terminal disease, with this extraordinary presence. How could he do it? Evyatar was a determinist, meaning that he did not believe in free will. But that's not the whole story. His determinism had a kind of acceptance and compassion, a deep being-withness to it. I invited Evyatar to be on this podcast, and we were so excited to sit down with each other and discuss philosophy and what it meant to find joy and peace with death on the horizon. And the very day that we were scheduled to record in Los Angeles, he actually texted me. I was staying in his house and he texted me from upstairs. And this is classic Ev, but basically he was like, hey, no problem if you're busy, but could you come up here when you have a minute? His bedroom is on the third floor of his home in Topanga. And I went upstairs and Ev was so weak that he could barely move. And we found out later that he had lost so much blood that he basically had the, oh shit, how are you alive level of hemoglobin. And it was an extraordinary process to help Evyatar from his bed to the car. He was too weak for me to carry him. He didn't want me to call an ambulance because he wanted to go to his own hospital. And so I sat with him while he slowly moved a few inches at a time and then a long pause. And we spoke. It actually would have been an incredible podcast, but of course that was not foremost on our minds at that point. He was on death's door in this moment, and he had humor, and he had presence, and he had grace, so much grace. And for me, it was an extraordinarily potent spiritual experience. It was deeply, deeply ceremonial. And of course, when I say ceremonial, I'm giving a nod to what many in the West, many in my communities, many listeners to this show experience primarily through ancestral medicine ceremonies. But it was a deeply ceremonial experience to be with him. And it was a lot like being in a Zendo, you know, the psychedelic peer support, not giving too much, not giving what wasn't asked, but being present and having levity and humor. And ultimately, we got Ev to my car and got him to the hospital. And then he got transfusions. And for that moment, he was okay. So we never got to do the podcast. And when Ev died last week, it was just so obvious that I wanted to share his wisdom with all of you. And I wanted to make art to celebrate my friend. And of course, what a beautiful thing to make art to celebrate your friend. And so what I've done today is I've put together a podcast, which includes readings of two pieces of writing that Ev composed, two interviews that I've interspersed, one with Erica Dean, dear friend of both Ev's and mine, who was absolutely pivotal in his care process, especially towards the end, and was deeply involved in this process with him, and who has a long history of working with ceremonial medicine. And a really beautiful perspective. And Eric and I had long conversations about this process, so it's a joy to have her on the show. And then welcoming back to the show is my mentor and spiritual guide, Benjamin. He's been on the show before. If you've been listening for a while, I'm sure you've heard. Benjamin is a brilliant person. And Benjamin and I were actually in this men's group with Ev. And so Ben had an opportunity to develop a really intimate connection with Evyatar in spite of never meeting him in person. And Ben just seemed like a perfect person to have this conversation with because his philosophy actually lines up a lot with Ev's, and he had a great admiration for Ev. So we have on the podcast Erica, Benjamin, some of Evyatar's writings, and then this hilarious, playful, insightful voice message that Ev sent to many of us after a particularly potent stay in the hospital. So I've woven these pieces together to create an experience for you, dear listener. Whether you were a friend of Evyatar's or whether you're just excited to learn from him, I've tried to weave them together to create a depiction, not specifically of the man, but of his philosophy and his way of being, and particularly his way of being with this. As the Yawanawas say, weak body, strong spirit. Few have the opportunity, grit, or wisdom to face death with a real presence. And in Evyatar's metaphysics, he saw this as a gift. This opportunity to be present with death as a gift. And that is why he declared his journey to be a ceremony. And it was an extraordinary gift for all of us to be in ceremony with him. I'm going to close out this opening with a poem by Hafiz. And this poem by Hafiz is such a beautiful representation of precisely what Evyatar showed me about what it means to stand at the greatest doorway of our lives and use it to learn how to live. Thank you, Evyatar. Thank you for being my friend. Thank you for being my teacher. Thank you for giving me permission to share your words, even posthumously. Here is a poem by Hafiz. Death is a favor to us, but our scales have lost their balance. The impermanence of the body should give us great clarity, deepening the wonder in our senses and eyes. Of this mysterious existence we share and are surely just traveling through. If I were in the tavern tonight, Hafiz would call for drinks, and as the master poured, I would be reminded that all I know of life and myself is that we are just a mid-air flight of golden wine between his pitcher and his cup. If I were in the tavern tonight, I would buy freely for everyone in this world, because our marriage with the cruel beauty of time and space cannot endure very long. Death is a favor to us, but our minds have lost their balance. The miraculous existence and impermanence of form always makes the illumined ones laugh and sing. And that is the Sufi poet Hafiz. And now, here are the words of and words about our dearly departed brother, Evyatar Frankl. Welcome to Life is a Festival. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Eamon.
Why do you think that Evyatar's experience of his health journey was so important to you personally?
Oh, wow.
I'm starting with a softball.
With the easy
giving
questions.
giving you something really easy. Something that was noteworthy to me in this was that your engagement with his journey felt spiritually important to you, and it represented your friendship with him and your care for him. But there was also more than that. And I'm curious, why was this so important to you? Why was being with him and supporting him during this experience so important to you?
The fact that he didn't have immediate family was something that really struck a chord within me. And it wasn't ever a thought. I was driving to a really good friend's birthday whenever he called me to tell me about the diagnosis. And it was like something had taken over. And I just turned around and I went to his house. And everything from that point forward took one step down in importance. It wasn't a thought. It never became a thought. It was this very intuitive and organic and aligned care that was being poured into it. And I think that's the only way that it actually could have worked. Ev was very sensitive to not wanting to accept any type of help that felt obligatory. And the fact that it just came so naturally for me to pour into him. And I was genuinely so curious about all of the little shifts that was that were taking place, and the slight change in numbers and the slight change in medication and the slight change in treatment plans. I had so much genuine excitement to be a part of that conversation with him. And that's the only way that he could have received it, is for there to be that really authentic love and excitement pouring through. So it was never a conscious choice. It was just a, this is it type of feeling. And there's never been anything that has felt more important.
Many of the people listening to this podcast will have known Evyatar because he had quite a robust community of friends. And I think a lot of folks will be interested in hearing his wisdom through this particular platform. Mm-hmm. But for those who are listeners to Life is a Festival and have not had the joy of knowing the philosophical mind of Evyatar Frankl and his humor and wit and all the wonderful things we loved about him, can you tell us a bit about who Ev was?
Oh, I'd love to. Ev was the most present person I think I've ever come in contact with. We spent so much time together at big gatherings, big community gatherings, where there was so much noise and distraction that was always around. And when you were face to face with Ev, you were the only thing that existed to him. And when you dropped into conversation with this man, you felt like you were the most important person in his world. And for that moment in time, you were. And it was a really big reflection point for me because it made me notice all the ways that I would be looking out of my peripherals, tracking the space and seeing if there was something more robust or exciting than what I was currently engaging in. And his presence brought me right back. And so he was present and he was kind and he was just a physical manifestation of boundless joy and excitement and curiosity. And he was passionate and brilliant. And he had thought long and hard about his morals and his values and what he stood for and what he believed in. And there was nothing more thrilling to him than when someone could change his mind.
You and I have both spoken of our perception of Evyatar as facing his illness with grace. Indeed, the word grace came up so frequently with him. And part of what my goal is with this podcast is to explain a little bit about the DNA of that grace and how that grace actually evolved and shifted throughout his experience. When you describe Evyatar as facing such a challenging experience with grace, what does that mean to you?
Ev went into this journey with a tremendous amount of curiosity and curiosity around the human body, curiosity around how far he could stretch that human body, curiosity around the human experience in general, his relationship to pain and discomfort and joy and pleasure. And I think that there were so many times where sitting on the outside of it, because he carried himself with so much grace and so much curiosity, there was this projection that I know I was, and I believe there were other people that were putting this projection on him that he was repressing the potential realities that he was facing. And now coming to the end of this journey with him, I don't think he was ever repressing anything. He didn't face the ceremony with fear. He faced it with curiosity. He didn't face it with attachment. He looked at it as an opportunity. And I think that you made a really good point by saying that he, as he continued along this journey and engaged in the ceremony, he continued to grow and expand and evolve. And the Ev that went into his diagnosis in September and the Ev that transitioned just recently, it's a very different man. And he used this as an opportunity to self-realize and self-actualize. And the grace that you talk about, I think it comes from his zest for life, not attachment to life, but his zest for life. I think it's really worth mentioning his little mantra, what if this is it? And that was something that he really started to ruminate on back in 2017. And I think that his being with that mantra for as many years as he had been and really doing his best to live by that mantra allowed him the opportunity to move through this so gracefully. This idea that absolutely any moment that you're experiencing could potentially be your last moment, and that's okay. And so many of his moments were filled with that mentality, were filled with that joy, were filled with that curiosity, with that love of this right now, present moment. And I think that's a lot of where his grace came from.
So much of this had to do with his relationship to determinism and the idea that there is no free will and there is no self, and that should actually make everything easier and give us more compassion and give us more presence. And what I loved with Ev is that he lived his philosophy. As a way of beginning to describe his philosophy and the way he thinks, we're going to start with a letter that he sent to many of his friends on April 12th. He got his diagnosis. He got a bone marrow transplant. It appeared that the cancer was completely gone, and then it came back. And he wrote this when the cancer had returned, and it's a meditation on his experience of facing potential death while still being hopeful. So this is a letter from April 12th, 2003.
Dear friends, I love you. I'm thinking these thoughts as I'm in the hospital. I don't think I'm going to die soon, but I might. I'm feeling the urge to share some reflections, so here we are. What would I want to be shared with you after I pass? What to say? What is there to say that you don't already know? The only thing more transient than my existence as this ego with this name may be this moment, which makes the attempt to think of a worthwhile purpose here somewhat absurd. Nothing matters, and yet this moment is everything. In this moment, I love you. I feel your love, and I hope you feel mine. Not only are we not nothing, a void, the only reasonable state of things when you think about it, but we are living the experience of being love. No object, no subject, just melted into this being. Everything matters. How crazy is it that not only something exists, even a tumbleweed in an infinite desert, compared to what I would expect to be the inevitable nothingness, would be worthy of so much awe and appreciation. And yet, we are conscious. We get to love, play, wonder, laugh, heal, be starstruck by nature, and experience spiritual revelation. Why do I want to tell you that I'm okay, really? Certainly if I die, in which case, at least I'm free of any confusion or aspiration, and more likely I've expanded, melted back into the amniotic fluid of existence, the sea of love of which our souls are the waves, emerging and receding into this materialistic existence, never leaving the ocean their home. For they are the ocean. To answer the last question, the never-ending desire for shared discovery, often censored by my self-conscious mind, weary of craving recognition above all else, and fortunately, currently outwitted by lack of sleep to ease its guard. And certainly, in this moment, as I contemplate these thoughts, I'm in peace, equanimous contentment. I'm mostly resolute that I will survive for many thriving years. I've learned so much about how to live, healed so much, shed so much, and I'm so excited to play, love, serve, explore, create, and appreciate. But humility continues being one of the biggest lessons, and maybe this is the extent of my life's arc. To sit at some initial peak, having toiled through inclines with eyes fixated on the ground, ready to traverse the ridge line with infinite majestic vistas in either direction, and accept that maybe the journey was indeed the destination. Maybe there is no victory lap. Maybe the inside world really is the more beautiful one, and the accomplishment of reaching the peak will forever be more exhilarating than taking in the finest panoramas. Or maybe it's all just arbitrary, and I just got unlucky. Then again, hard to believe I could be more lucky than to have lived the life I've loved, though trust me, it's not been easy, and lived the love I've lived. And in this case, this belief feels true enough to dictate reality. These days, I'm in bliss when I'm grounded in how wondrous this life experience is. Just this moment. What a life.
Benjamin, welcome back to the show. It's such an honor to have you here, and so important to have your voice in understanding and interpreting the words of Evitar Frankl, because you knew him, and we sat together with him in a men's circle weekly, and you two had very similar philosophies. I would love for you to respond to this first letter, and then I'll ask you to respond to some letters afterwards, but what do you think was so special about Evitar's philosophy and how it allowed him to meet this particular challenge?
For me, the most extraordinary thing about Ev and having spent the time that we did with him is that he lived his philosophical understandings in a very deep way, a very embodied way. That the understandings that you hear in that letter were lived out from moment to moment for him. And it's extremely rare. We can all explore mentally various philosophies and try to understand the nature of things. But when we're faced with something as enormous as the possibility of leaving this body and leaving this life, it really puts our philosophies to the test in the deepest way. And Ev really rose to that. He rose completely to it, I would say. You can hear here in this sharing this idea of coming up to that ridgeline and having this enormous, expansive view of life. And that is, in fact, an accurate description, I would say, of where Ev had arrived during this time. He's saying there, was it the journey? Is it the appreciation at that peak? But his life's journey somehow brought him to a place where he really did have a deep sense of equanimity, a deep sense of joy and of translucence, rather than being wrapped up in his own challenges, even though they were considerable. His impulse was actually to be curious and interested and engaged with the people around him in his world. And he maintained this state of freshness, this state of being in that eternal now that he mentions here as a wave in the ocean of consciousness or the sea of love, as he beautifully calls it there. And that, I think, was very striking to witness and experience in the time that all of us in the group spent with him. Because even though each day we spoke with him, he probably had far greater struggles than any of us. He still was authentically interested in the contours of the lives of everyone in our group. And he offered valuable, wise counsel. And I think everything I've seen from the group that's sharing after his passing brings the same thing to the fore, which is that he would have events and be with the people who were caretaking him and show up fully for them and joyfully for them and maintain this great sense of upliftedness.
It wasn't like he was straining to do that. So that's one thing that was interesting. It wasn't that he was like, okay, philosophically, I have to do this, so I am going to force myself to do it. So that was interesting. And then two, he wasn't spiritually bypassing, in my opinion, but there were times that he would check that. And so there was like this renewing and renewed presence with it. I'm going to read Ev's Principles on Waking because I think that's the foundation. And then we can talk a little bit about this cancer journey as a ceremony. So this is Ev's Principles on Waking. And this is basically, you wake and remember this, which, I mean, for many of us, we wake and we're suddenly contracted into whatever our anxious preoccupation with is in that moment, whether it's a relationship that isn't working out or a job that we don't like or whatever. There's this like wake and contract. And I think this for him was wake and expand. So this is Principles to Remember on Waking. Number one, context. A star exploded. And as the debris mixed, I, a conscious being capable of appreciation, joy, connection, wonder, and love, emerged. That is insane. I am here for a sliver of eternity. I have the ability to experience extreme euphoria and joy and relieve others of sadness and pain. Just that is worthy of awe and joy. That's the first principle to remember on waking.
Number two, every moment is filled with plenty to appreciate, but my mind has been optimized for genetic survival, not well-being. Overcoming this is straightforward. The challenge is that I need to remember a few things. One, to be in appreciation. I have the ability to determine where to focus my attention and therefore my life experience. I just need to exercise it. Meditating strengthens my ability to select where to place my attention. Appreciation is the fundamental unit of positive human experience. Worrying, stressing, regretting, desiring, judging, all distract from appreciation. The second thing that I need to remember is I am the only way I could be. And this is Ev's determinism, of course. I am just a bundle of atoms / sensations rolling through this life experience, a product of my genes and my environment. I could have never done differently. Therefore, regrets and shame are misplaced. And others are the only way they could be. Treat them with compassion and respond with equanimity. Secondly, to that point, I am the only way I could be is it's a game / movie. Consciousness is along for the ride. Everything is determined. So stress, anger, sadness, etc. are biological responses. Best not to lose myself in them. Accept them as transient parts of the ride with a smile and let them pass. Three, I have everything I need to be happy. Desires are evolutionary products and often detrimental to my experience. They're usually misleading, i.e., attaining that which I desire often won't achieve the expected satisfaction. Don't compare myself to other people or other circumstances. If I do, remember that I have enough. And even if I attained what others have, I'd probably still compare to the next better. So true. And within that is, what if this is it? Every moment is an opportunity to enjoy or grow, at least meditate and exercise my ability to control my emotional reaction. If stressed or worried, what's the worst that could happen? It's okay to be sad sometimes, a necessary part of the mechanism that allows me to be happy. In a world where I could only be happy, I would become desensitized to that state. And then finally, just being alive is a gift if I remember to appreciate it. The rest is bonus. So that is conclusion of part two of Ev's principles to remember on waking. And then the final one, final principle is, other than being in appreciation, work to secure basic needs and make others happy. For self, be physically and mentally healthy, sleep, food, exercise, mental health, create, play, connect with others, be intellectually engaged, in flow, learn, explore, heal. And for others, the most fulfilling thing is helping others. Work to improve the world and lives of others. Look out to help others in the little things and dedicate time to make the world better. Do work that is fulfilling, engaging, and impactful. In summary, a star exploded. Every moment is filled with things to appreciate. And determinism is the way to basically do. And that basically what you should do is secure your basic needs and help others, which feels very straightforward, but actually has quite a profound result. And it was funny, while I was reading this, I was thinking that, Benjamin, this is very much how you live your life. Like,
that's true.
You and Evryatar were very much fellow travelers in this way, though he a bit younger than you. And I know that he really looked up to you, and I know that you really admired him.
I did very much. And I think these principles to remember upon waking demonstrate exactly why I had that admiration, because not only did he derive these very concise and very well considered principles for living, but he also lived by them. He truly did. And he was in a deep acceptance that determinism brought to him about life and everything moving around him and within him. And that acceptance allowed him to show up with a great deal of fullness and presence, even in the most challenging of circumstances.
But how? How does it translate? I agree with everything he wrote.
Yeah.
I do not live the way he lives. Okay. And it's not simply, I feel like it's not simply a matter of Eamon's legendary lack of self-discipline. Like, in your experience of knowing him, what was the magic that helped translate his philosophy to a way of living that would be helpful for people who are learning about him and learning about the way he lived? Because you really did do it through to the end. My curiosity is like, how do we take these philosophies that are so obviously true and translate them? And perhaps he had this set up as principles on waking. So maybe there's something here that was like the habit of coming back to these principles. But I'm curious, in your perspective, what is the magic of taking a philosophy that makes so much sense and then actually translating it into the way you live your life?
I think to begin with, because he had, with care and time, uncovered these principles, these perennial principles, he was confident in them. And so he felt that they would guide him with clarity. And so not only was he deterministic in his approach, but he was also determined. He was determined to live in the way that he's described here. And that meant, as you said, that he was always checking his math. He was always self-observing. If he was spiritually bypassing, he would notice that and he would correct it. He was always making those corrections in the moment by being self-aware. And that's something we witnessed in real time. And many of his other friends, I'm sure, had the same experience. First, there was the deriving of these principles. And although we can say they seem self-evident, actually, that's not necessarily, because you can believe many things, right? There are many philosophies that you can orient yourself by. And he was aware of many of them and had read widely and spent a lot of time thinking about these subjects and listening to thinkers like Alan Watts. And so he had spent the time to do a distillation and come up with what can be conveyed here in about a page, core wisdoms. And then he really worked in a determined way to live by those. And I think it's the combination of those two things, that derivation, that clarity, and then hewing to that line, even through enormous challenge. So he had to manage things like the fear that might have emerged, or the tendency to move into darkness, or the tendency to become totally self-absorbed. All of those things were things that he managed successfully throughout the course of his illness. And I think the fact that he regarded this whole journey, this whole health journey, as a ceremony tells you something about that orientation, because it meant that he was determined to make that productive for himself, to derive understanding and learning and growth from it. He was determined to suck the marrow out of exactly whatever life offered him.
So this idea of the ceremony was a really interesting part of this whole journey. Ev declared that this cancer is a ceremony. I'm going to make this a ceremony. This is how I want to do it. And what was so interesting about that is that by declaring it as such, he invited us into being in ceremony with him, which allowed the process to be communal in a way it might not have otherwise been. And I had the privilege of spending a fair amount of time with him, particularly over the past few months, staying with him in Los Angeles. And it was interesting being able to observe him, because I was living with him. So I was able to observe him when he was not necessarily hosting or entertaining, or he would be at the hospital Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and he would come back and he'd be like too tired for the hug. And he'd just be like, I'm going to bed. But he was always like quite gracious about it. But I got to see that it wasn't just, okay, he oriented himself to this philosophy. He said that it would be a ceremony and then everything was fine. Not at all. I mean, he was in a lot of pain at different times, but it was like this thing that was so interesting is presence with the experience. With Ev, it was like he was continuing to come back to being in full presence. It was just fascinating to watch it. And by watching it, there was a being with it that was being in ceremony with him. And I opened the podcast by speaking about what happened when we tried to do our podcast, which is that was the day that I had to take him to the hospital. And that was the most ceremonial time for me, was when he was too weak for me to even carry him. And we were together and he was still joking. I would have been such a fucking brat if I had been in that situation. He was like, every movement felt like I just finished the hardest workout of my life. And I feel like I would have been such a brat about that. And so this idea of being in ceremony. I'm curious your perspective on it.
So that day you mentioned when you were bringing him in, you discovered upon arrival that in fact he was right at death's door, that he easily actually could have expired that morning. And as he was joking and being compassionate and present, he was right up against and facing that the veil in that moment. And if that isn't a full realization of a lived ceremony, I can't imagine what is. And I really felt throughout this period, he was making a deep and intelligent relationship to that veil, the next world, and by extension, this world. He mentioned when he went through what he called his morphine ceremony, where he said, as an intense an experience as he ever had with any psychedelic, that he realized that he was already dead in a profound sense. He realized that past, present, and future are coexistent, and their distinction is an illusion, that he stepped into this eternal now. And that's the place I believe he was essentially in when you were walking together on the way. It's probably the most profound relationship to the process, the deep process of dying, that I've ever seen in the people that I've walked through that. And they say in the Tibetan tradition that your relationship to dying, the time of your moving out of the body, is the most profound and important part of your life's journey. That final chapter is what will determine how your consciousness moves beyond. And I certainly think he did a wonderful and admirable job of meeting that transit that we could all learn a great deal from.
Erica, we return to you to discuss what ceremony means. What does it mean to live like a ceremony? As we are friends, I know that you've done a lot of work in ceremonial medicine circles and supporting facilitation, and that you've really been deeply dedicated to your own journey with transformative healing. What does ceremony mean to you? And particularly, what has this ceremony meant to you?
What ceremony means to me has changed in the last month. After experiencing this with him, what ceremony means to me is a opportunity to refine and an opportunity to be in whatever is with open acceptance and neutrality. It is an opportunity to take radical self-accountability for the way that you are creating your life and the way that our stories and our attachments play into our every moment and every relationship and every connection and every choice. And ceremony empowers us to see ourselves from a place of so much compassion and so much love and so much excitement, and lean all the way into all the aspects of ourselves that are looking for our attention. I've had the absolute pleasure of sitting in such profound spaces and to be a witness to and to be a receiver of deep healing. And never in my life have I been a part of something that has felt so rich and so fulfilling. And to be in ceremony with Evyatar was, I had the opportunity to witness someone so endlessly devoted to his own growth up until the very end. He took a therapy call 2 days before he was admitted into the hospital this final time. He was journaling and meditating and digging so deep into his experience and to why he was reacting to that experience the way that he was up until the moment that he transitioned. I watched him face off with aspects of himself that had been repressed and pushed down for the majority of his life, and him meet those aspects of himself with so much love. When Ev first got diagnosed, we were talking about the spiritual energetic of this illness and what he felt like that was. And he was so sure that a lot of what this was his repressed anger and repressed sadness and repressed emotions that he hadn't processed through. And so in order to heal, he didn't just see this as going to the doctor and getting chemotherapy and getting all of his infusions. He saw it equally as important to do the work spiritually and emotionally to filter out a lot of the stagnant energy that was sitting inside of him. And so from the very beginning, he had a very clear idea of where this was manifesting from emotionally. And so a lot of the ceremony for him was empowering himself and learning to assert himself and asking for his needs and allowing people to love and take care of him and creating boundaries. And that's ceremony. Ceremony is to have something come into your experience, whether that be physically or energetically, that creates a constriction. You have resistance towards facing this. And how can you soften into that? How can you soften into exactly the aspect of yourself that's asking for your attention? And Evyatar was masterfully navigating his way through the emotions and the aspects of himself that were really asking for him to take a look at them.
My favorite part of Evyatar's ceremony was when he decided that he was done having a ceremony. He was like, I'm done. It's not a ceremony anymore. I'm over it. My body doesn't want it. I don't want it. Ceremony over. And he sent many of us a voice message. I think I got 20 minutes of him talking about that from the hospital. But this is his experience of what he called his morphine ceremony, which at one point he was like, I get why psychedelics are useful for end of life. And so now I'm going to play Evyatar's voice note about his experience of being done with ceremony only to get more ceremony. So here is the man himself.
Here's my little bit of a joke. Joke goes, this guy named Evyatar Frankl goes from going through cancer, but everything's fine. It's, oh my God, it's all ceremony. Whoa, I need to do third person jokes more often because then I can just make fun of myself more readily. What have I been waiting for all my life? Anyways, now it's all just a ceremony. Everything's good. Oh my God, you should. And then everyone else, their friends, who also apparently sounds annoyingly nasal, is, oh my God, you're just handling with such grace. And then Evyatar's, no, you would too, just a matter of circumstance, blah, blah, blah. You show up to the occasion. But anyways, the guy Evyatar's like really leading into this whole like the ceremony thing. And it really does help him and it's really insightful. And it's an accurate or at least very useful metaphor analogy. One of these days I'll learn the difference between the two. Just to really help you get into it, I'm also going to use the word I interchangeably with Evyatar Frankl. Because, geez, Evyatar Frankl, like, who came up with that? Who has that much time to be pronouncing that name more than, like, once in their lives? Anyways, as I was saying, Evyatar Frankl, also known as I, woke up on Sunday of last week, normal time, 9 a.m., could move around, could crawl to the bathroom, certainly couldn't stand or walk. Eventually, a friend who was staying with him was able to, over 40 minutes, help him into the car. They went to the emergency room. There had been some internal bleeding. None of that is to be concerning. I should have framed that differently because it's not really cancer-related. It's just the body just getting sick of all this shit. And from probably Monday through Wednesday, these have been like the hardest days of the cancer journey. Just a lot of discomfort and just extreme weakness, like sitting in a wheelchair was hard. Going to the bathroom was nearly impossible. And this is, don't worry, it is a joke. It is a joke. You just gotta trust me on that. And I know you will. Because if not, you're fucking out. But the joke is that as Evyatar was deep in these days of greatest hardship throughout this cancer journey, which I haven't bothered to put in the thought, but presumably the hardest days of my life. I don't know. But anyway, we'll figure that out later. Where he's like, all right, life, no more ceremony. I'm done with this. Let's be over this. And of course, there in that desperation, in that inner looking, and intention setting and pleading came the biggest ceremonial lesson. Unnecessarily hyperbolic, potentially inaccurately hyperbolic. So we're just around in those insights and reflections came incredibly profound, deep lessons and insights, growth, healing of the type of healing one gets from ceremonies when one integrates, right? So I was like, the joke of it all is that I was in actually quite a fair bit of discomfort. They gave me morphine on two different days, and it was like visual. It was out-of-body experience. It was non-dual. And I think for me, a lot of the level of healing has been through actually being taken in a very ceremonial medicine way out of my body into the spiritual experience. But then key to this healing part is reintegrating and feeling that, oh, hello, body. Oh, hello. I am just pure consciousness along for the ride. And then, oh, hello, I get to have this beautiful ride, this beautiful experience. And so many of the things that I'm excited to be in this dimension, on this planet, however you want to phrase it, to do, does require a human body. So to see what I really am, this spiritual being, but not just lean on that as a way to dissociate from the human experience, but rather to let it be a place to stand on the sideline for a second. Let's not use the word silent, but to stand in a place where I can see both the spiritual body and the physical body in this material realm, understand the ways in which I've been carrying certain pains and traumas and subconscious patterning, and reintegrating that in some beautiful and surprisingly deep and effective ways, at least so far it could just be fresh, so that I can live more wholly, so that I can live with my judgments, the ways in which I do feel self-love towards me, and just truly feel that it's so silly, not in a pejorative way, but just laugh at it, laugh with it, all these different parts of me just coming together and be like, oh, this silly life thing, no, you're doing so great. And this self-judgment and the way it's being manifested is judgment towards others. Yes, you are just doing your best. And that is your kind of manifestation of the shit that this physical body grew up with. And now I'm laughing at how it's come into me, into my operating system. And I'm laughing with it as a companion throughout this journey. But I'm already noticing ways in which it's preventing me from showing up with blockages towards people through this judgment. That's really cool. How's that your joke for the day? Because it has nothing to do with everything I said, but the fact that I just kept you on the phone for 10 minutes. I love you so much. And that is no joke. Talk soon.
That's just incredible.
Isn't that an incredible voice note?
It's just incredible. Wow. Wow. Just pure awareness along for the ride. And holding that dual understanding of his spiritual nature, his human nature, their inseparability, which you saw in the way that he delighted in hearing stories from each of our lives during the group, as he was staring out from a much deeper, more eternal place and relishing all the aspects of each of our journeys and what we were going through. And yeah, it's just extraordinary the place that he was able to reach in his life journey.
It's interesting, even like hearing on the voice note, like he keeps
checking himself all the time.
When he's
like, is that hyperbole? No, I wasn't.
Exactly. He's like the biggest thing. No, actually.
Always so self-honest.
So Ben, for the listener who does not know Abiathar, and there'll be a lot of people listening to this who knew him and who are comforted to hear, to have a closeness with his philosophy right up to the end. But if you're sharing this with someone, let's say you were speaking to a friend who didn't know Av,
what would you say is most salient to take from this man's life to make our own richer? Because that was part of his philosophy, was like to help others in small ways. And my hope is that this podcast can help others in small ways. Can you summarize and distill Ev's philosophy in a way that would be most helpful for others?
Well, I guess what I would first say is the background of the whole conversation is, what are we doing here? What is it that we're doing here? What are we as beings, as human beings, as spiritual beings and embodied, doing here on this planet together? And some might say we are trying to build the edifice of ego and get a lot of toys to play with and have a lot of exciting hedonistic experiences. But from Ev's point of view, and from the point of view of great masters of the past, the point here is understanding our true nature, seeing what's really happening here, and allowing ourselves to see from the deepest place within us, a place that loves and understands and meets the world. And I feel that Ev was able to accomplish that in his life. He was able to understand in a very profound way what we're doing here together. And I feel the principles that he distilled are a little roadmap that he left for us. He left us a little roadmap on a napkin, and he said, try these things very humbly. This is how I found my way up to the top of this mountain that he described earlier, where he could see the vastness of that vista. And I've learned a tremendous amount from him, and even more so in this process of his community rising up around this transit. So I'm definitely going to be following Ev's sketch. I'm definitely following his notes.
I feel like you already do. I feel like that's the thing that's so interesting in watching someone put this into practice versus talking about it. Because that's part of why I wanted to talk to you about it. Because I feel like many of the things that Ev has held dear and has been working with are things that you have as well. And the way that it shows up when someone is acting this, not just believing it, but acting from it, feels like grace. And you seem to walk through life with grace. You handle things with grace. And Ev... my name for Ev was Eviatar Walks with Grace, because I don't know, it felt biblical to me. So it's just like a cute thing to call him. But that was the thing. He was even making fun of it in the voice notes. And his friends will say that he had so much grace. But he did. He had grace. And the grace, I think, is in the living from it. And I think the idea that it's principles upon waking is itself like an important note. It's not like these are Ev's principles broadly. These are principles upon waking.
Which, of course, is a double entendre, too. He means waking in the morning, because he means always keep it fresh in your mind. And he also means some capital W there. The principles upon waking.
And on that note, to close our conversation, waking. I think death can be considered a kind of waking. Through my work with ayahuasca, my relationship to death changed a lot. I really feel like death is good. It's a doorway into something. And this human life has many challenges, and I cannot imagine that it is a doorway into a place that is harder, scarier, more painful. It does not make sense to me. I don't believe that. I believe that it's like the Ram Dass idea of death being like taking off a too tight shoe. So I feel very clearly that Ev's consciousness, such as it is, if it is still differentiated into an Ev consciousness, then it is somewhere nice. Or perhaps, and this might be more aligned with kind of his way of thinking, that the kind of Aldous Huxleyan reducing valve of consciousness, that idea that the brain takes consciousness and puts it into an identity, and then death releases it. And so perhaps Ev is in the blissful oceanic oneness.
As he put it.
But you mentioned something in our group about different spiritual traditions saying that the spirit abides for some period of time. I'm just curious, as a way of closing today, where do you think he is now, and how shall we honor him as our friend and brother?
A song with a group that he played on the ukulele very appropriately, with a beautiful line: if heaven and hell decide they both are satisfied and illuminate the nose on their vacancy signs. The idea that he's not in heaven, he's not in hell, He's in a place that's far more expansive than either of those constructed human ideas of what consciousness does when it moves out of the body. I feel that he was open and available and receptive to the broadest expansion of possibility as he let go of the journey, the learning journey that the body allows for us. So I would say his sharing of absorbing back into that ocean, that sea of love in which we are all waves, as he put it, that's exactly where I feel Ev is abiding now, is in that great sea of love that we all emanate from, that our lives rise out of and fall back into.
And I think that what Ev would have wanted most, which is an interesting thing, what Ev would have wanted most is to give that to others. And life has some interesting serendipities and convergences. We got the news when we were sitting in our men's group, the 1 hour in the week. And that's quite a bullseye to hit for us to get the news. I have friends who were in Europe and they got the news coming down off acid and reasoned that he had died while they were peaking. And they're like, God, that's exactly what he would have wanted. It's what he would have wanted. They're in a weird way as we let go of our friend and we wish that he were here with us. But there does seem to be a sort of like rightness in the unfolding of these matters that would not only would align with his determinism, but that the determined story is actually worth reading, worth being.
He had such a great sense of humor, right? So of course he would want to insert a little bit of humor in his orchestration of this learning journey.
For those who did not know him, Avitar Frankl was quite a light and a dear friend and someone who was also a teacher. And Ev, we are so grateful to you and so honored. Grateful.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your light with us.
So Erica, as we conclude our conversation today and our celebration of all that we've learned in this experience, I want to bring us to the perennial conversation that you and I shared throughout this. We spoke many times on a very specific subject. I would like to think that I was one of your main people to talk to you about this very thing, which is, how do you help? How do you help? How do you resource yourself to help? How do you show up for someone with such a big experience without making your experience smaller, without overworking yourself to the point where you are under-resourced and can't help? Erica, what did you learn about helping through your experience of supporting Avitar over this past year?
Thank you for asking that question. I think first and foremost, it is essential when you move into something like this, if you have the ability. I understand that there are some people that get really thrown into an experience like this that don't have the ability to have boundaries around it, but it's really essential for you to check in with yourself and ask what your deepest why behind supporting is. And for me, so much of my journey in the last year has been around me getting really real with myself around the ways that I have been in codependency through the majority of my life and how a lot of the times I would support from the wrong place and I would help from the wrong places. And so there was a continued conversation with myself and some of those people closest to me to check in and to remind myself what my deepest why was and to make sure that it was coming from a very authentic and loving place. There's this aspect of myself who I lovingly call my victim, and she shows up in so many different ways. But one of her favorite costumes is to take this external experience that's happening around me and make it so much about me that I'm able to draw out love and affection from other people by turning into that victim. Woe is me. This is so hard. My best friend is going through this. And whenever I would feel that she was present, I would stop. And I would take my time and I would take a step back. And rather than attending to the external, I would turn my attention to the internal. And I would remind that victim how safe she was and how loved she was and how she didn't have to she didn't have to do what she was doing. And I would wait until she felt resourced. And then I could turn my attention back to what was happening outside of myself. And I think that's the really beautiful and potent thing about death, being in and around the frequency of death, is this opportunity for constant refinement, because you are in service to something that is so much bigger than your drama, and you are in service to something that is so much bigger than your stories. And what you have so beautifully coached me through this entire experience is that I am having my own experience through this. And it's important that I stop and take time. And that was something that Ev really was a big realization for him during his morphine ceremony, was like, oh yeah, I'm human. So of course I'm going to have things come up. And of course there's going to be these different aspects that pop up during all these things. And two, you were consistently reminding me that it is indeed my experience. And my experience is, it wouldn't be there without me. So to completely remove myself from my experience, it's not possible. But the beautiful thing about being in and around the frequency of death is that it really does allow you the opportunity to refine so quickly, because everything that would come up for me, I was able to look at and say, yes, this is real. And when Ev was getting really sick towards the end, you start to see the power of your own projections. When someone is dying, they are no longer porous to your projections. And when they die, they're not at all porous to your projections. So you can see what you're putting on someone else. You can see how you are creating the story and using them as the form to keep the story going. When Ev was really starting to turn his corners, and when we were doing all the infusions at home and there was a lot of chaos that was taking place in the house, Ev was frustrated. His body was failing him and he was exhausted. And so we're running around trying to figure out how to make all of this work. And we would make mistakes, and they weren't really mistakes, but we were learning as we went. And so Ev would pop at me sometimes. He'd get frustrated. And of course, face to face with him, it would be so easy to be like, so sorry, babe. And he would always say, you have nothing to be sorry about. But then I would walk away from that moment and take myself to the basement and cry, because I was having my own experience, and I didn't want to make mistakes and I didn't want to mess up. And that was real. But it was so much easier for me to turn to the part of myself that was feeling sad or feeling scared and say, baby, you're okay. You're okay. And I've got you, and we've got you, and we've got to pick ourselves up, and we've got to go back into this, because there's something really important that's asking for us right now. And it was this beautiful opportunity to hold myself with a tremendous amount of compassion so that I could hold this thing that was so much bigger than me.
When Art Gimbel, who was the co-founder of Fest 300, the company I worked for as a festival reviewer some years ago, died in a car accident, I remember what my mother told me then, which has stuck with me ever since, is that whatever you feel in the face of a loved one's death is correct to feel. It is confusing and strange, and why am I angry? Why am I guilty? Why do I feel all these things? And much like the way Evyatar was with his experience, it's Rumi's guest house. You greet it and let it pass through. And I remember speaking to you about the guilt. If I did this thing slightly the wrong way, does that mean that my friend will die? Have I killed my friend by not shutting the door properly? How am I responsible? And what we spoke about at the time is that gives you the illusion of control, where you have no control. You are not responsible for his illness. And what you are doing is showing up and doing your best, as we all are. And I think the majesty of this was the presence. He was so present with his experience, and he allowed us to be so present with his experience and with him. And when I saw him in LA and I stayed with him, I was like, Ev, how do you want me to be? And he's, I want you to be you. I want you to be exactly the way that you are. He didn't want me to be delicate with him. He didn't want me to be delicate with him in ignoring that he might potentially die. And we would sit down and talk and be like, so how does it feel that you might actually die? And he said it was the happiest he'd been in his whole life. Mm-hmm. Certainly not in the last month, because that sucked. That was very hard for him. But preceding that final month, he was the happiest he had been in his life. And many of the people who loved him also felt that way. And many people talk about this in the context of facing death, that suddenly all of these simple things that you've looked over in your desperate rush for some kind of dopamine hit or to compensate for some long-standing story, all of that necessarily melts away in the face of your own mortality. And you actually do enjoy the breeze. And you do enjoy the sight of an unexpected bird or some such thing. Mm. And by declaring his cancer journey a ceremony, he invited us into ceremony with him. And we all got to be a part of that. And all of us got to have our own process with it. You, in my opinion, you especially got to have your process, because it sat so clearly in the trajectory of your ceremonial work and your work supporting in ceremony and helping other people. It sat exactly in the trajectory of your life. And of course, with Evyatar's passion for determinism, he would say, of course it's that way. In the same way that we got the news in our men's group, of course it's that way. There was a sense of unfolding that happened. And I want to tie this into this, the concept of this podcast. Life is a festival. Why is life a festival? Why is the number one reason life is a festival? Because like a festival, life ends. The impermanence creates the potency of the immediate experience. We love our festival weekend. We love Burning Man because it's so immediate, because it ends. The temple burns. It is over. Mm. And I think Ev had the potency of that potential ending. It was never like, okay, this will be terminal. There was always a hope, but it was always present. He was present at death's door. When I helped him from his bed to the car on that day, he was on death's door with me. I was with him as he could have died at any moment in that time when he had lost so much blood. And that ceremony to be so present, and what a gift from him to let us into that and to teach us how he faced it. And for this, I am forever grateful. And I'm grateful to be able to share some small part of it with our listeners on the show today.
Mm-hmm. I think that something that I am so grateful for, and I know that you... It's an uncomfortable thing to face off with potential death, not just because I am deeply attached to the body that is Evyatar Frankl and my friend, but because facing off with this potential is really putting you face to face with your own mortality. And it's not something that we look at often. And I realize how often I turn away from the elderly, and how often I grimace at the people that are on that doorstep. And the fact that you were able to be with it in the ways that you were, and to allow the levity and allow the comedy and allow the joy to be there while there's also this other thing that you're facing, and how I was able to sit with him and to be with him and look him in the eyes and not look away. To be present with him as I'm looking into the eyes of my future as well, my mother's future, all of my other friends, all of my other beloveds. It's what Evyatar was representing for us was so much more than just losing a good friend of ours. It was facing off with all of our futures, and the grace that you had to stay with it, and the grace that I had to stay with it. I think it's fortifying us in a really special way. And it's why we were both there. It's why we were both at that doorstep with him, is because we had the ability to stay with something of that magnitude and not look away, but look so deeply into it.
And so now here we are, a community of bereft friends, and we miss our friend, and it comes in unexpected ways, like crying at the airport without any sunglasses, which I felt was a depiction of healthy masculinity personally.
Absolutely.
Frankly, it was the most dignified cry I've done at an airport. I've had undignified up all weekend cries at airports, much different than this. But here we are, a circle of friends, and death can bring us closer, and seeing all the shares in the WhatsApp group that we're all in, and all the ways that he touched us, and so many people talking about his philosophical mind and how the way he lived was an example, and the way he died, very much an example. And so, dear listener, if you did not know Evyatar, I hope you know some small piece of him today. And I'm sure that you can see reflections of him in people in your lives and experiences you've had. And if you're in the position that you must be with a friend who is in the process of dying, may it be such a blessing as it was for us with Ev. And we are so grateful for you, Evyatar. Thank you for being here, and thank you for letting us into this extraordinary process.
Hey, babe. Random thought of the day. Although no promises that it will be the last random thought of the day. But for now, it is the only thought of the day. The only random thought of the day. I've had other thoughts today. I am officially rebranding the place we live, previously known as Topanga Canyon, to Camp Topanga, because I've decided that at least my life going forward, which new egotistical Ev has determined that if it's my experience, then I've no qualms pulling you all into this, but I'm just like living summer camp for just the rest of my life. I think that's essentially life 2.0, which is summer camp. And I love our little Topanga thing. I just came back from this beautiful acupuncture session and grabbing tea with my neighbor later, and we're going to talk about some cool stuff. And yeah, so anyways, you now live in Camp Topanga. Just thought I'd let you know. Hope you're having a great day. Talk soon.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.